Hello, this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com, and on the line with me today is Neil Howe, who is the co-author of the book, The Fourth Turning, What the Cycles of History Tell Us About America's Next Rendezvous with Destiny. And this book has been pivotal in helping me understand my place in history and actually pivotal in the creation, and this is probably news to Neil, in the creation of the whole website, TeachMeTeamwork.com. And Neil Howe is a historian and an economist. He's a senior advisor of the Concord Coalition. He serves as a marketing and public affairs consultant to a variety of corporate and nonprofit groups. And Neil lives in the place where I grew up, which is the Washington, D.C. area. Neil, I'd like to welcome you to the call.
Tom, it's great to be here.
Well, to start off, the Fourth Turning talks about generations and generational differences, and maybe that would be a place to start for our listener to hear your take on how generations differ and maybe move into what cycles of generations there are.
Well, we actually started, as Bill Strauss and I, we started writing books together in the late 1980s, and there was one book we spent several years actually putting together, which was Generations, which is a history of America told from a very different point of view than most people have ever heard it before told, and that is as a series of collective biographies of different generations, each one growing up at a certain time, coming of age, courtship, military service, becoming midlife parents and leaders, and growing old. And what we found to our amazement, that even adjacent generations that grew up right next to each other, you know, in terms of birth years, had entirely different collective life stories, and experienced, obviously often experienced the same kinds of events, but because they did it at different ages, drew entirely different life lessons.
What is a generation? You say this is a generation, and people, I think, have heard Generation X and Baby Boomers. What is a generation?
It's a group of people born over a limited period of years, about the length of a phase of life, say birth to coming of age as an adult, maybe 20, 21, 22 years in recent American history, that shares a certain common set of attitudes and beliefs, shares a certain location and history in common. In other words, they sort of feel they shared the same basic social mood, growing up as children and coming of age. And also, you can tell what a generation is through self-identification. They feel a bond between each other.
Hmm.
And even in the past, we can often identify that through looking at groups of politicians and artists and writers, for instance. You can tell who belongs into a group and who doesn't belong into it. And it's one way of getting a feel for generational divisions.
So let's take I taught in Manassas, Virginia, and many teachers, which is close to you, and many teachers today fit into, two generations. And that would be the baby boomers and Gen Xers, and I imagine that there are some silent generation teachers still around, or people from the silent generation. For someone who's in an office or working with a multi-generational facility, what would your information help them do in just their daily, day-to-day life? What would help them, what kind of understanding would your material bring to them?
Well, I think one of the basic lessons, and this is certainly our most recent book, is called Millennials Rising, for instance, and it's on today's newest generation of Americans born since the early 1980s. The generation coming along after Generation X. And our lesson when we talk to teachers, high schools and colleges about this new generation is that, is first of all to tell them a very important rule of history. And that is that when a new generation comes along, everyone assumes that it's just going to be an elaboration or extrapolation of the previous generation. You know, like the previous generation, but more so, right? And that never, ever happens. Each generation represents, in some fundamental way, a turning of the corner and new attitudes and beliefs that are totally at variance with the previous generation. And in many ways, opposite to the generation that's twice removed. In other words, a generation in midlife when a generation is coming of, is just growing up as kids. And, I mean, you can see this again and again in recent history. During World War II, which was a time when, the great GI generation, Tom Brokaw calls them America's greatest generation,
yes,
was out conquering half the world, and they were building battleships, and they were, during the 1930s, they had been members of these huge political movements and so on. Everyone wondered about these new teenagers that were growing up during World War II. This is the Bobby Sox crowd. These are the first kids for whom the word teenager was actually coined. And people were wondering, well, what's this generation going to be like? Because people were aware, growing up as kids during this time of war when older people are making all these sacrifices on their behalf, what are they going to be like? And everyone thought, well, when the war was over, they were just going to go on and, be the same very activist, world-conquering kind of generation before them. But everyone was shocked, because in the late 1940s, as people began to see this generation, they saw to their amazement that their motto was not, it was not changing the system, it was working within the system.
Hmm.
And they got their reputation on college campuses as the quiet or silent generation, because they kept their heads down during the McCarthy era. They didn't want anything to go on their permanent records. And when they interviewed for jobs, in the late 40s, early 50s, their first questions were about pension plans. None of them wanted to start their own business. They wanted to work for big corporations. And not only did they want to have the longest possible commitment in their work life at the earliest possible age, they also wanted to get married at very young ages and have kids at young ages, right?
Hmm.
Well, that was a very different kind of generation from the GIs before them. And it had consequences later on in their lives. This is later on, the generation in the 1970s that began to have the midlife crisis, right?
Yeah, right.
Want to go back and relive that youthful adventure they missed the first time around. That continued to reverberate. The consequences of that new kind of generational shift reverberated for many decades to come. Well, another generational surprise is by the late 50s, early 1960s, people had gotten used to the silent generation, right?
Right.
Conformist, lonely crowd, gray flannel suit. And if you look in the early 1960s, people began to think about this new post-war baby boom generation, right? Product of high fertility right after World War II. And they began to think, well, what are these kids going to be like when they finally begin, go to college? Well, if you look at the news weeklies in 1963-64, you will find that their predictions for the boomers is that they would be more conformist, more compliant, more technocratic than the silent generation before them, right?
Looking at them as just more of the
same. More of the same. No one had any clue as to the youth explosion that was about to hit America. You can look at Margaret Mead. You can look at, Keniston. You can look at all of the, great social scientists. No one had a clue. But once again, you find a new generation that didn't just follow the path of the one before. And you go ahead again, look at the late 1970s. Again, another phase of life had passed, and people are beginning to wonder about the young kids who are growing up as little children at the time of Woodstock or Watergate, right?
Right.
What were they going to be like? Well, if you look at a, there's actually a famous article written in American Demographics, on this subject, on the post-boomers. And their prediction was that these post-boomers were going to be a post-materialist generation. Post-materialist. Think about that. They were going to even be more ideologically driven. They were going to be more passionate, right, about great principled causes than the one before. Well, a couple years later, we began to meet, the MTV crowd, rap music, Tom Cruise feeling the need for speed. You remember Michael J. Fox with
yes.
Wall Street Journal under his arm? This was definitely not a post-materialist generation. I think we would all agree. In fact, we began to meet the collective persona of Generation X. Once again, not an extension of boomers. In many ways, reflecting a totally different composite personality because, of course, they were genuinely the children of the consciousness revolution. They were the kids who were growing up to be self-sufficient free agents at a time when families were crumbling and schools were in chaos. This was a totally different experience. It shaped them in fundamentally different ways. And there's one transition more that's taking place right now. One more surprise. And we saw this by the mid to late 1990s when people finally began to think, well, you know, it's been 20 years. If you think of Gen Xers as everyone born in the 60s and 70s, well, what about these kids born since the early 80s?
Yes.
Right? And once again, people began to talk about Generation Y.
As
what is
extension.
Generation Y? It's the letter coming after X, right? If anything doesn't tell you about this linear kind of forecasting technique that people do, that's the term. Well, it turns out that the millennial generation, these teenagers, don't like the term Generation Y. It's one of their least favorite terms. Imagine being called by the letter after the generation you already don't like very much, right?
Yes.
But it also suggested that people were into linearism. And people's predictions for millennials in the 1990s was that this generation would be more culturally cynical. They'd be more free agent-like, independent in the economy. They'd be more prone to risk-taking in things like, you know, sex, drugs, violent crime. They would be more collectively pessimistic about their future. I mean, all of that. Well, now that the actual data is coming in about these millennials, we begin to see that all of this is wrong. They are none of those things. We've seen a 70% decline in the rate of violent crime since the beginning of the 1990s. We see teen pregnancy go down. We've seen even sexual activity in high school go down. We see SAT scores. They're the highest average scores since 1974, and considering that a much larger share of this generation is now taking the SATs, that's quite an accomplishment. People are beginning to notice very un-X-like characteristics in these kids.
Mm.
Teamwork, collective optimism about the future, pressure about not whether their whole generation will make it, but whether they will live up to the fact that everyone else in their generation is going to make it, right?
Hmm.
That kind of pressure. We're seeing planning about the future, long-term planning, as part of this pressure. We're seeing a very different kind of generation, once again showing that generations do not follow each other linearly. Now, if you're a teacher or your parent, this kind of information is very useful in this kind of historical perspective, because it suggests that once you begin to get used to this idea that generations don't just follow each other, you begin to think, well, why don't they? And what kind of rules are they for, right, how generations come after each other? And here are just a couple ideas, I think, that
okay.
will make sense to people. First of all, a new generation that comes of age, by coming of age, I mean, you know, graduating high school, getting into college, beginning to think about being an adult. A new generation coming of age, first of all, tries to separate itself stylistically from the generation that came just before it. We see this happening, you know, started happening with the boy bands and the cover girl groups for the millennial generation, right? Separating themselves from the kind of Nirvana grunge and alt rock sound of the Xers before them. We see this a little bit now in the culture. That's one thing that happens when a new generation comes of age. They also begin to try to compensate and correct for the excesses of the midlife generation that is often the dominant generation of their parents. That is to say, their biological parents and also the people who are running school systems and, you know, legislators and running Hollywood and everything else. Right now, for the millennials, that's the baby boom generation, right?
Right.
The consummate narcissists and individualists. And we see this generation developing certain attributes which are in many ways kind of correctives to their attitudes. And the other thing you find, and think back too of the, you know, remember that silent generation we talked about?
Yes.
Well, they were in midlife when Gen Xers were kids. Think about it. A generation of total conformists as kids, raising these kids who became total risk-prone adventurers, right?
Yes.
Nomads. People who take all their risks early in life. And what do we find with Generation X now that they're growing older? They're slowing down. They're taking fewer chances as they're hitting midlife. Just the opposite of the silent generation, right? Who took no chances early in life and started taking more chances with their famous midlife passage.
And this is none of this is a surprise to you. now that you've studied this.
It's not, because we've seen this over centuries of American history. That's why it took us so long to write our original book, which was Generations, our 1991 book.
Yes.
It took us, we went back and we had to re-piece together history. We had to look at history as conventionally told. You know, most history, let's face it, is the history of midlife people, right?
Right.
The presidents and the doctors and the you know, the legislators. But there are also histories of old age, and there's histories of childhood, and there's histories of courtship and all that stuff. And what we had to do was take those histories and then break them to pieces, kind of, you know, like with a sledgehammer, into little fragments, and re-piece them together along what we call the generational diagonal. For instance, if you wanted to tell the story of Abraham Lincoln's generation,
yes,
you'd have to look at, you know, child rearing in the 1800s, right, in the 1800 to 1810 decade. You'd have to think about coming of age, right, around, or courtship and things like that around maybe 1820, 1830. And then you have to look at midlife. Well, you get my drift here. You finally have to look at, for some of those who, you know, the Emersons and so on, who lived late into that century, you'd have to look at being an old person in the 1870s, 1880s. And you'd have to piece together something which, what, along what we call the generational diagonal. And once you begin to look along the generational diagonal, when you look at history, history looks very different. And one final thing, and this is worth thinking about, because I think in the case of millennials it's very important, one final contrast that you notice with a new generation coming of age is that it breaks from the stylistic patterns of the generation just before it. It compensates and corrects for the generation in power. And it also fills the void or the vacuum left behind by the generation that's departing beyond elderhood, that is to say, that's dying away.
Yes.
And right now, in the 1990s, what's the generation dying away? It's the GI generation.
Yes.
Right?
I just saw a news program on that.
Generation of heroes. It's the generation of Joe DiMaggio and Jimmy Stewart and the valedictories to Iwo Jima and D-Day, you know, that we see all the time on TV. All Americans know that that generation, a great generation of heroes and team players and collective optimists, are dying off. And if there is one void in America that all generations need, needs to be filled, that's the void. Well, think about it from the viewpoint of youth. They don't directly think of it that way, right? But they feel, youth always feels, what role is missing and what role is open to them. It's a little bit like an ecological system, right?
Yes.
You got a lot of plants and things growing in some environment. You take one plant out. Well, that's the space for the new plants to grow into. And it's just like that with generations. That's why we find these, what we call a fourfold pattern of recurring archetypes. And people who are interested in that can, you know, look at our books. You know, we call them the artist, the prophet, the nomad, and the hero archetype. Why they recur in pretty much the same order constantly in the history of modern societies is partly what we try to explain, and certainly why it's a, why this has happened with such, you know, magnificent variety in American history.
So this millennial generation, the bulk of whom are in elementary, middle, and high school. There's a few in college.
They're beginning to, yes, they're now actually hitting the junior year of college this year.
So. Okay, so this is what you're referring to as the hero, the next
this
hero generation.
The next hero archetype.
Yes.
Now, we're not total determinists here. We don't pretend to assume that no matter what history deals out, it may not happen, you know, that these are pre-prescribed in some mystical sense.
Yes.
Horrible events in history can change us. In fact, the only time in American history when we have seen this sequence, in some sense, skipping a beat or skipping an archetype, was the Civil War, the aftermath of the Civil War. And partly, I think it was because it was probably the worst tragedy in American history, the great crisis for which anyone can imagine a better outcome than what actually occurred. We think that other societies have maybe have had more of these tragic outcomes than America. But we do feel there's a strong tendency in this direction. And think of it this way, because we also, in our more recent book, The Fourth Turning, which came out in 1997, we sort of turned it all around. Instead of starting with generational differences and working toward the end of a book with a theory about cycles and history, in the fourth turning, we started with the whole question of cyclicality and rhythms in history, and looked at rhythms that many people have noticed in politics, you know, because of realigning elections, or in war, or in foreign policy, or in culture, and demography, and the economy, certainly, with the long wave. And we tried to say, can we explain these cyclical rhythms that people have noticed in various fields through some sort of broader theory of generational change? So in the fourth turning, we turn all that around and look first at the question of rhythms in history, and we come up there with a what we call a model of turnings, which is the idea that as generations follow four types, so are there four different kinds of eras in our history, which constantly recur. And we, you know, we call them first, second, third, fourth turning, and the fourth turning is the crisis era, right? That would have been like the American Civil War or like the Great Depression and World War II. And we are due for a new fourth turning starting sometime in this decade and lasting for the next 20 years. And of course, because a recent mood change in America has been so much in the headlines lately, we have had a tremendous resurgence in sales of the fourth turning, certainly over the past year and a half.
Yes.
And we're not, our emphasis in the fourth turning, of course, is not to actually predict the tangible or concrete events. What we're trying to do is predict why it is that different combinations of generations react so differently to whatever event history might throw out, right? It's a little bit like, you know, history always throws out little sparks. But if some sparks quickly, you know, die and go out, and others ignite a conflagration. And that's really what the fourth turning certainly deals with. And what's interesting when you think of the lineups of turnings and generations is that you think about each generation coming of age matching a turning, right? The GIs came of age in the last fourth turning, the Great Depression and World War II.
Yes.
And formed this tremendous reputation for civic construction and, you know, civic virtue and reward, and, you know, they kind of, you know, government kind of grew up with them all their lives, gave them their first jobs and the GI Bill, and then they became senior citizens, and we had huge expansion programs, you know, for that, always for their phase of life, right? Then we had the silent generation who came of age during what we call a first turning. And in their history, this was the American high, right?
Right.
That kind of period of kind of collective optimism about the future, but very little emphasis on individuality. The boomers after them came of age during the period, what we call a second turning, or a spiritual awakening turning. In our recent history, we often call that the consciousness revolution. You know, from the campus riots, inner-city riots of the mid-60s to the tax revolts of the early 80s. The common theme here is throwing off social obligation, right? And that was their turning. Their turning that came of age. Generation X came of age from the early 80s on to the early 00s, right?
Yes.
20 years. And we call that a third turning, or we call that generically an unraveling. And unravelings in American history are kind of the opposite of highs. In an unraveling, individualism is strong and flourishing, and institutions are weak and discredited, right? And we think of Generation X as, in a sense, the best embodiment of that ethic, right? Strike it on your own. You know, lose $10 million. It'll be good for you. It'll enhance your reputation. Basically, take risks, do it on your own. Don't trust any large organization. I go around and I look at a lot of bookstores, you know, when I travel and talk. And one thing you always notice going into a bookstore today is that all of the most upbeat, optimistic books are all about me, myself, and I, right?
Hmm.
And all of the most downbeat books are all about what we have in common, the end of the family, the end of society, the end of America, right? Think about it. And that's because we've been in one of the, what we call a third turning, with this kind of combination of generations. And third turnings follow awakenings. And what's the lesson of an awakening? Everyone should turn inside themselves and be comfortable with who he or she is and not trust any larger entity. First turnings follow crises. And what's the lesson of a crisis? We all have to band together. We got to fortify, right? That was the American high. And so you think of history in these terms, and you think of it being driven by generational change in this way. And remember that each of those generations coming of age, right, grows older, becomes leaders. And one interesting pattern we see in our history is that these boomer generations, you know, born during highs, coming of age during awakenings, as they move into and through old age, as elder leaders, they always steer the country into and through the next great crisis. It's happened every time with this type of generation. Certainly the American Revolution, the Civil War, the New Deal, and World War II, and we think we could be on track to see that happening again.
So am I correct in saying that the boom generation, let's say that a school is filled with teachers, and again I'm focusing on those working with kids, and they could be teachers or counselors. Many of them are either boomers or Xers, and they're working with a generation, this millennial generation, that has a desire to team and work together and find out what we have in common. Yet the people who are working with them, boomers and Xers, their focus is not that. It's a
complementary relationship. Here's something you can take to the bank, because it's a great rule in history.
Okay.
Generations in midlife, as parents and teachers, they do not necessarily, when they're thinking about what to do with their young, they don't necessarily want the young to replicate their strengths and virtues. They want the young to complement them, to provide what they cannot provide. And this is, a pattern that goes through history. People often ask me, you know, these boomers are such individualists. How can you say they're raising team players? How is it possible? And my answer is, did you ever stop and wonder how it is that the GI generation, right, the good soldier generation,
yes,
ever could have raised boomers? How did that happen? And if you go back and look to these Dr. Spock babies, you know, born after World War II,
yes,
and you look at Dr. Spock, he says in his third chapter, we need more idealistic children. And by the 1950s, when the GIs not only, you know, remember the GIs, they saw fascism and communism, these huge totalitarian lockstep ideologies race across the globe. Then they looked and they saw the silent generation coming after them, and they thought, oh my God, you know, these people are even more, you know, conformist and group-oriented. We need for kids to think for themselves, to be independent spirits and minds. We can't have them become victims. So we had increasingly a steadily more indulgent style of nurture, with these GIs deferring to boomers on values-oriented issues and the culture. You know, GIs remain totally in charge of the system, right, the economy and the politics and everything, but they encouraged boomers to move into this whole new realm of values so that they would solve what, by the late 1950s, was considered the worst two problems facing America. The worst two problems were too much conformity and an end of ideology. Now, you have to admit that looking at the rest of the boomer life cycle, they have certainly solved those two problems, right?
Yes.
We no longer worry about conformity in America, nor about the end of ideology. You know, every boomer is his own ideological parade almost. Okay? So this is important. And the same thing is happening with boomers raising millennials. Think about this. I think about President Clinton, with all of his roots in the 60s, right?
Yes.
Going to Oxford and protesting the system and the horrible things that his parents' generation were doing, the environment and doing to people in third world countries, just all of that. And think about what he meant in terms of Bill Clinton's role in the counterculture. And then think that by his second term as president in 1997, he went on national TV and he said, you know, come to think of it, it would be a great idea if every school child in America were to wear a uniform. Now, tell me this. How do you get from here to there? How do you get from that coming-of-age experience to that kind of recommendation? Or you can take the example of his wife, Hillary Clinton, who in the mid to late 1970s was writing law school articles for Yale Law School on how every child ought to be given rights, you know, legal rights to sue their parents.
Wow.
Okay. Now look, at the book that came out in the late 1990s that she wrote called It Takes a Village.
Yeah.
All about the crushing paternal and maternal power of parents to shape kids like bits of clay, right? To have them do everything for the community that's necessary, okay? And again, I would ask you, how do you get from here to there? It's because boomers, as they become older, they want in their children the things that they cannot do themselves.
Mm.
When it comes to thinking about the big ideas, the great norms, the priorities, thinking about the culture, thinking about values, boomers know that they excel in that. All generations defer to them on those issues, and they can continue to do that for the next couple of decades, right? But what about doing big things together, being a good citizen, cooperating? Boomers know they can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
They know they're incapable. They always have been incapable of that. That's what they want their kids to do. And just as the GIs looked at the silent generation, and that redoubled their effort, right, to raise more individualistic kids, as boomers grew older, they looked at Generation X. And they looked at a generation so individualistic, right, that redoubled their determination. This cannot happen with another generation. We cannot go another step further in this direction.
Wow.
And that is why we're now in the era of zero tolerance, team teaching, team grading, non-competitive sports, collaborative learning, career academies, student juries, service learning. That is why we're doing this. And that's why these kids are growing up with very different collective attitudes. One of the things that's fascinating is their aversion to risk. I've talked about this with many teachers. I most recently talked about it with the head of the Naval Academy at Annapolis. And he said he had the most amazing experience 2 years ago. He, as always, he takes the incoming midshipmen and he has them and he brings them together in these big focus groups. And he asks them, what's the thing you most want to do while you're here?
Hmm.
And previously, he had always been hearing kids talk about, I want to be the best. I want to stand out, right? All that stuff.
Yes.
And he heard this from kids. He says, I don't want to let anybody down. I want to be competent in everything that I know that I have to be competent in. None of this standing out, none of this, right? None of that competitive edge to these kids anymore.
Wow.
And people notice that. And when I talk to teachers, a lot of them saying these kids are better substantively prepared. They actually have a better grasp on structured knowledge, which is great because that was all the thing we despaired with Xers, right?
Right.
But they also say they're less creative. They take fewer chances. And now a lot of things contribute to that. I think that the grade inflation contributes to that among the college-bound. You know, you push them all against A's, and what do? Right? They're worried about not getting an A. They're not worried about standing out in the positive end, right?
Right.
So it leads to this great risk aversion, and I think also the coming to the fore of girls is also an interesting trend in this generation, because certainly leading the leading edge of this change are girls more than boys. And to some extent, boys are kind of the lagging edge of this millennial shift. And I think because at least part of the explanation is that girls care more about what people think of them. I think in an academic situation which has more of a social dimension, that girls excel better. And also when it comes to risk aversion, that's less of a problem for girls than it is for boys. And one of the problems now for boys is leading a lot of boys in this new millennial era not to like schooling. I mean, certainly in the opinion attitudinal polls we look at is that the reason why boys aren't going on to college as much as girls now is because a lot of them, by the time they get to grade 12, decide, you know, they really don't like schools anymore. They don't,
wow.
They don't like these zero-tolerance, risk-free institutions where the best you can do is just measure up to your peers. Boys being a more naturally, perhaps, risk-prone, kind of individualistic gender, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, you know, one could spin many theories about why that's true. But certainly there's a dawning awareness. We have more of a boy problem with millennials than a girl problem, which is certainly the problem we had somewhat with Xers, but certainly with the boomers. Where a real awareness that things were rigged much more in favor of the boys and the girls.
So can you talk about the fourth turning and how the job of the millennial generation, what it's going to look like for them?
Well, when you think about these turnings, and we think about, you know, what follows a third turning, which is an era of sort of, you know, unbridled individualism, when the kind of culture feels exhausted and civic authority feels weak, and you know, we kind of feel like we're in an era we are now. History shows that those are always followed by fourth turnings. And fourth turnings are when the society decides to, you know, tear down worldly institutions, particularly in the realm of politics and economics, and rebuild them from the ground up, always in response to a dire threat to the nation's very survival. History shows that, or suggests that, when there's an event, a threat doesn't naturally arise, that fourth turning leaders will find one or even invent one in order to mobilize collective action. So the culture refines a social purpose, you know, often in the form of propaganda. Civic authority revives. People begin to refine themselves as members of larger groups. Think of what happened to America in the 30s, how different it felt. And that certainly was the decade which most distinguished GIs, coming of age, than the generation that just preceded them, which was the lost generation. And this is the same thing that we are going to see, I think, increasingly differentiating millennials as a generation, as they enter this kind of post 9/11 era from Generation X.
I've got to interject. It is February 17th, 2003, what you just said as the what defines a fourth turning, or at the beginning of the fourth turning, it seems like that is in the news daily.
Yeah, well, increasingly it is, and we've seen a lot of shifts. You know, we've seen more people thinking about their country and more expressions of patriotism. We've certainly seen a movement away from emphasis on civil liberties toward collective security, right? I just saw a news clipping the other day that the average American is videotaped 7 or 8 times per day in public places.
Wow.
And, you know, no one is discomforted by that. In fact, most people are probably find that comforting, which is certainly wouldn't have been true 5 or 10 years ago.
Yes.
We see more formality in public ceremonies. We see even more formalism now in clothing. You know, there's also the old dictum that hemlines, you know, go up and down with the stock market. That's part of it as well. We see a new emphasis on serving the community. Again, the millennial generation is at the cutting edge of that. We see a movement away from kind of consumer fragmentation into the specialized retail niches and boutique shops. Some of the biggest retailers that have done very well over the past year and a half, relatively well, are places like Walmart and Target. And again, it's teens that are coming to these places. So I think we do see the beginnings. And the question is how fast is going to proceed. We actually have a big debate on our fourth turning website about whether this is a bit early for us. We are actually predicting something more toward the middle of this decade. And so we're a little bit agnostic on, you know, whether a fourth turning has actually begun or not. But certainly one can look at the current mood and say that it certainly foreshadows what we expect to happen later on.
So now, of course, this website, teachmeteamwork.com, is I'm focusing on team and teamwork. And so how does teamwork fit into the life of a millennial? Because I was reading your book this morning, or an excerpt from it, and you wrote that the outcome of the fourth turning may depend on the mettle of the generation then coming of age, and
right,
on whether, as children, this generation will have developed powerful team instincts. So what is, can you explain that, the relationship of maybe those working with the millennials and the millennials' role as far as teamwork and pull that component?
I think what older generations will do is to mentor this and to be a midwife of what's happening. And other generations will look on with mixed feelings. This always happens. remember that those GIs who encouraged boomers to become, you know, self-actualizing individuals, right?
Yes.
All those shows like, you know, remember that Art Linkletter show?
Yes.
Say the darndest thing.
Yes.
You know? We want them to grow up and be, you know, bright and cheerful and to say all these incredible things. Well, once they started to reach age 19 and 20 and say incredible things and grow their hair in incredible ways, GIs decided, whoa, you know, this isn't quite what we wanted, right?
Yes.
And then there's this great mixture of feeling, because a lot of GIs were horribly offended by this, and they started to go off and live in, you know, Sun Cities and Leisure Worlds, and frankly want to separate from their grown-up children. And eventually, of course, they let the boomers take over the culture, and they remained in charge of fiscal policy. And that's kind of how that settled out. But the point is that there was this, once you actually see this new persona in play, taking on a life of its own, invariably the feelings within a generation are very mixed. And I think that the same thing was true about the silent generation when they raised Generation X.
Hmm.
Remember, this generation in the midlife crisis, they were the ones who wrote those Judy Blume books, you know, the New Realism. Show those kids everything horrible, the things that no one ever taught us back in the 1930s, right?
Yes.
We grew up in a shoebox in a closet, but we're going to show our kids everything horrible so that they can grow up as truly resilient, right? We're able to rebound from anything. Well, that was great in theory, but once they actually started seeing some of these kids, they began to think, wow, this isn't quite what we wanted, you know? Kurt Cobain was not exactly what we wanted, right?
Right.
And the same thing is going to happen to millennials. And I have already noticed a real shift. To the extent people complain about kids today,
yes,
it's shifting. Back in the early 1990s, the complaint was, and the fears was, is that we're going to see X, X, X grow ever bigger and ever more wild. And we had predictions of super predators on our streets, right? We could have more drugs. We were going to have more, you know, we could have kids that were going to move out of the home at age 7, and then we weren't even going to go to school anymore because we were going to be so completely de-schooled and we're going to be so practical. And that was the prediction. Now it's very different. People don't fear anymore or that much complain that millennials are or will become too individualistic and too wild. The increasing complaint, you can see this in the recent Atlantic cover story, called, you know, the organization kids. So increasingly the complaints are, these kids are too organized. They're too robotic. They're too groupthink. And there's something eerie about these kids, you know?
Mm.
There's something a little brown-shirt about them, you know?
And could you go back in history then and look at the news clippings about what's being said?
Look at the GI generation who came of age from the late 20s on. Initially, the fears were they would be another generation of Hemingways and Fitzgeralds, right? Cynical, individualistic. They were going to be barnstormers and rum runners. You know, think of what the lost generation as young adults did to the 20s. Well, the GIs came out from under that reputation. And initially, that was everyone's fear.
Yes.
By the late 30s, Sinclair Lewis was writing books like It Can't Happen Here about new fascism in America, right? You had FDR mobilizing these kids, and these kids responding. They were wearing identical uniforms and CCC, you know, dam building and tree planting groups.
Yes.
Well, by the time you get to the end of World War II, everyone had totally forgotten that original fear about kids that would be too wild, and instead a very different kind of image, right, was beginning to build in America. So this is what generations do for us. They give us historical perspective. They give a sense of dynamism to history. And they get us away from that view that everything is just long-term linear secular trends, which basically makes history, you know, terminally boring, right?
Yes.
Instead, it gives history a sense of dynamism and a sense of constant action and reaction, which all of us have experienced even in our own lives. And it explains many of the different kinds of experiences or periods of disorientation we've had in our own lives, even with our own family.
So, Neil, is there a specific strategies that you can suggest to those working with millennials today, especially those that are in school or, you know, elementary, middle, high school? What is something that we can do to help prepare this generation? Because when you said...
I think that the most important thing to prepare them is to understand that they are not like they are not like the way we are, and in fact, we are not only not like them, we were never like them. Who they might resemble, we might be better off looking at our parents than looking at our own lives.
So how do we go about, you say, to prepare yourself and your children for teamwork?
What this means is that there will be things that will be vital for them to actualize their sense of power and life in history, and a sense of their own trajectory as in the future that will be unlike what we experienced at the same age. And as an example of this will be their role in organizing the community and in politics, we think will be much more central to the way they will define themselves than it ever was for baby boomers.
Hmm.
So let's face it, define themselves as countercultural, right? As define themselves as sort of as a generation with a little bit of a destructive mission when it came to the system. This will be a generation with a constructive mission, and they will see that in terms of the dangers they see facing America's future. You remember and their attitude toward government is actually an interesting reflection of that. And this will rub a lot of boomers the wrong way, I think, on both sides of the political spectrum. When boomers were young, the idea that government was, of course, part of the system. And our main perception of it was, if anything, it was too strong, right?
Right.
It was putting radiation in our cranberries, and it was threatening the whole world with its destruction. We had environmental problems, and frankly, also, it was psychologically battering. It made our parents into these robotic types who couldn't feel, you know, they could never have fun. All of that stuff. I mean, we lived an over-regimented life, an over-ordered life. And our sense of public authority and public structure was probably one part of that problem. And boomers have tried throughout much of their life to remedy that by moving their focus much more towards spiritualism and culture and values and other things. Well, think of millennials growing up. To them, Woodstock is so far away. It's like, you know, what would have been the St. Valentine's Day for boomers, right? I mean, it's way, way beyond when they were born.
Right.
What's their experience? Well, their experience has been, I don't know, Waco, Oklahoma City, O.J. Simpson. It's been certainly Kosovo, 9/11, the war in Afghanistan, possibly a new war in Iraq. And what do they look at government? They look at a world in which there is no public order. Who tracks these people at Waco? Why do you have these large areas of the world that no one seems to control? We don't know. You know, remember during the Cold War, every square inch of the globe was under someone's control.
Right.
It was either the Soviets or the U.S. or our clients. Today, it seems we live in a world of global chaos with huge areas of the world and huge areas even of our own country, which are beyond anyone's knowledge and control.
Hmm.
And I think that this is an example of how we will have a generation with a very different perspective on this. When we were growing up as boomers, we looked around in our suburbs, and our parents were all very civically engaged. You know, they all knew each other. They all left their doors open for each other. And we went off and did our own thing. So we lived in a very, you know, it was a great era to be a kid because everything was so secure, right?
Yes.
Well, think about these millennial kids. Their parents are all very self-oriented. And the way in which parents get to know each other in a typical suburb today, and I'm talking about Gen X and Boomer parents,
yes,
is that their kids introduce them to each other, right?
Yes.
Often in school events. Hi, I'm Caitlin's dad, right? I'm Jordan's mom.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that the world is very dangerous out there because there's so many individualistic people and no one can control them. That's why we have to be shut inside all the time. That's why everything has to be organized for us all the time. Think about how differently you will grow older and how differently you will look at the world having one upbringing as opposed to the other. Another interesting contrast, of course, in this whole thing about system versus culture, right? What boomers hated was the system. And what we wanted, of course, to engage ourselves with the world of values. We wanted to look inside, right, and find
right.
ourselves. And you remember that? Remember that scene with, in The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman, right?
Well,
plastics, right?
Plastics.
These boom, with millennials, it's not the system, because no one cares for the system today. In many ways, it's much more the culture. It's media. As a matter of fact, I often think that if you ever did a graduate today, the word wouldn't be plastics, it would be media, right? I just have one word for you, kid, right? One word for you, media, right? Because in many ways, that's what these kids think is most wrong with the world around them. It's a culture that has gone beyond limits, gone beyond bounds, gone to incredible excesses. They really do not think much of the organized culture, of the big media companies, the entertainment companies. You know, they see, they're obviously entertained by it, but they certainly don't respect it. I'm thinking of shows like Cribs and so on, where they see how the rich and famous live, you know, trashing their own homes and stuff.
Right.
And then people wonder why they don't pay for CDs and they download them instead. Well, they have no respect for this world. They see, when it comes to, when we've asked polls about how we think that young, you know, we ask kids, how teenagers, how you think you will someday, in which sphere of life do you think you will someday have the most impression in changing America? Religion and culture at the bottom of their list.
What's at the top?
Economy, politics, and the foreign, you know, foreign policy. In other words, all these left-brain things are at the top of their list. All these right-brain things are at the bottom. Why? Because they see Mick Jagger and, you know, Santana, they're still winning awards. They see these geriatric people that are still totally in control of the culture. Again, think of how different that was when we were young. When we thought about midlife people, and
right.
I'm talking about boomers here, we thought of people who had were actually absolutely blind to the culture. There was nothing they played or were performed that any of us listened to. And these kids, on the other hand, golden oldies is like their second or third favorite genre. They have no problem listening to that stuff. They think that, yeah, we've defined it, we were very good at it, we kind of totally filled that niche, and it's therefore not interesting to them. And some of the people, you know, obviously are just plain creepy. You know, we got the Michael Jacksons, right? We got all these, we got Phil Spector, we got all these strange, you know, survivors of that whole era of cultural revolution, which to the view of these kids just seems kind of just creepy and antiquated and musty to them. And you think, do I want to really specialize in this area? To the extent these kids specialize in culture, it's now video games. A lot of them are actually going specializing in video game music, which actually promises to be a whole new venue and avenue for the growth of the music industry.
So is there a way to avoid the fourth turning?
Probably not.
Because I was talking with my mother, who's a silent generation.
Yes.
And she said, Tom, that sounds so depressing.
Well, you don't need to avoid it. What you need to do, because you can't really avoid it, it's sort of like forest fires, right? Occasionally you need a forest fire. You need to burn down the undergrowth. You know, that's just the way the world is. You guys can occasionally burn down institutions and rebuild them. And fourth turning serve a function. When I talk to them, to people, I always remind them, this is an apocalyptic prophecy. We've been through these eras before. And typically we've solved enormous problems that we could not have solved in another era. We felt great about ourselves, and often we've even profited along the way. It's a time of great danger and a time when history moves swiftly. But it's also a time, again, to remember we solved problems that could not have been solved in another era. In a fourth turning, for instance, one could imagine a solution to global environmental problems, a real solution, right? Not just talk about it. You could imagine a real solution to nuclear proliferation. In a third turning, hopeless, right? You just debate at the UN or something, right? You know, you're not going to solve the problem in a third turning because no one trusts institutions. No one's going to actually follow through with any plan. And that's what these millennials are focused on. Yeah, talk is fine, and they'll talk and all that. But what they're interested in is, how do you actually implement it to get everyone on board so so that it actually happens. You know, let's face it, you know, boomers are great on talk. Senator John McCain had a great quip the other day. He said, you know, when it comes to boomers, everything they touch becomes more meaningful but less effective, which I thought was, you know, a nice little joke. and I think boomers recognize that this is a problem with their own generation.
So our expectation of the millennials is that we should expect them to take action, solve problems, and to do it together, and we should support them?
We should support them. We should provide the things that they will look to us for. Millennials will always look to boomers for wisdom on the culture, wisdom on values. Remember that the elder, what we call the missionary generation, the post-Civil War generation of MacArthur, FDR, Einstein, Henry Stimson, Secretary of War, these were called the wise old men of the World War II New Deal era. And they guided the young GIs. The young GIs looked up to them. So look at the account of how George Bush Sr. Entered the armed forces after Pearl Harbor. He heard a lecture by Stimson, the Secretary of War, at Yale, talking about the duty, you know, of every citizen to fight and join the struggle for good against evil in the world. And George, boy, he listened to that, and that's all he needed, you know. He just went down, he signed up the next day.
Wow.
And he was flying his jets in the Pacific, you know, only a few months after that. And they looked up, or read the passages of LBJ, looking back and describing what he and his peers thought about FDR. They said, we looked up to him like Abraham Lincoln to our generation.
Wow.
He meant everything to us. He suffered for us. He led us. He knew where we were going. We provided the strength. We provided the teamwork. But he knew what it all meant. This is the kind of relationship I think that boomers will have with these kids as they grow older. This will be very important to them. And Generation X will also provide a great role, because it will be Xers who will be the pragmatic midlife managers of what happens, right? Boomers will be the elder leaders, but Xers will actually be in control of stuff, making the decisions. And it will be Xers who will teach millennials how the world really works, right? Cut through all this, you know, all this vague, you know, boomer talk, and let's get down to how things really happen. And that will also be incredibly valuable for GIs, because it will help them actually not just set the right goals, but actually get things done. And I think that a lot of Xers are already aware, increasingly, that they are different from these kids coming along after them. I will say that to some extent in the culture, the culture industry in America is very slow to get it, which often happens. Remember that people who make the culture tend to be in their 30s?
Yes.
And people in their 30s, they're too young to have teens as children. They're too old to have them as siblings. They're often the last to wake up and see what's actually happening to teens. So we see a lag in the culture industry. We always do. But I think in many other walks of life, Xers are aware of what's going on. Xers certainly are extraordinarily protective as parents of young children today. And a lot of the slowing down of Generation X is the kind of slowing down where Generation X becomes generation exhausted, right? And they just build a moat around their home. They say, yeah, these kids, I'm really going to take care of them. And for many of them, of course, it's a sense of accomplishment, because it's treating their own kids the way they were not necessarily treated when they themselves were growing up.
So what is what is the key understanding if someone reads The Fourth Turning, and I recommend to anyone listening to this recording to read that book, what is the key understanding they must get after reading that book?
I think the understanding they must get is that when you look at kids, you're not just looking at kids. You're looking at someone who grew up in a certain era, has a dream of a certain life ahead of them, and will go on and live that life, and that certain things will be valuable to that kid, which not necessarily ever valuable to you. And that's in a way, I think for an educator, that's the key insight. That as you go forward in time from generation to generation and try to, what we all try to do, build on civilization, try to build something better and bigger for posterity, that we realize that when you build, it's not all of the same kind of blocks. There are different kinds of blocks you need in that edifice. And that the kids you're teaching will not do the same things you did. History will not call on them to fill the same role. And they will need other things. And you need to feel comfortable with that. I would say that's the single biggest insight. Now, how you apply that, you can get by actually reading our books, or perhaps, most of all, my most recent book called Millennials Rising, which
yes.
is actually on at this new generation. And, the fact that they feel special and confident and sheltered and conventional and all these things we talk about. And what specifically that calls for. But I would say if there's one single global lesson, that would be it. These kids feel and look at life the way you never did.
Wow. I think maybe we could, in closing, just review how people can learn about your material. Of course, there's the book, The Fourth Turning, What the Cycles of History Tell Us About America's Next Rendezvous with Destiny. And you co-authored that with William Strauss.
Yes.
And that was published in 1997, and it's out in paperback. So that, and it's available at virtually any place.
All of our books are in print. All of them are available from Amazon. Generations, the History of America's Future was 1991. We did a book on Generation X called 13th Gen, Abort, Retry, Fail, which came out in 1993. We did Fourth Turning in 1997, Millennials Rising in 2001. And we have additional products which are available on our website. For instance, we now have a book out on called Millennials Go to College. And we now talk to a lot of colleges because they're getting used to these new kinds of kids, right, who as soon as they get outside the classroom, they whip out their cell phone and they call mom, right? This is
yes.
a great new kind of kid that they're seeing on campus. And so we have a product for them. We did a product for military recruiting, and we've actually done work for all of the branches of the armed services. We have a product on millennials and the pop culture coming out. And so we have another one actually on millennials and the workforce. So these things are all in the works. I would say by the end of 2003, these things will all be available.
And your website again?
The website, our business site is lifecourse.com. Lifecourse, one word, and that's our company. And we also have a discussion site. It's probably one of the largest discussion sites for a nonfiction book out there. It's fourthturning.com, and it's people trading observations on generational differences, on the culture, on education, on differences in global generations, on theories of history, and all kinds of interesting things for people who want to find out more or share their own views.
It's a wonderful site. I've been to it many times, and to see the discussions that are going on, it's a vibrant community, that is for sure. Well, Neil Howe, I so appreciate your time, your insight, and the gift that you've given the rest of us. I know that it's an invaluable gift to me personally, in helping me understand where I think my drive for the whole teamwork piece comes in, and working with the millennial generation.
Well, thanks, Tom. It's a delight for me always to work with this generation, and certainly I'm happy to come here and talk about it with you.
Well, and again, you can access the links from teachmeteamwork.com. Those will all be next to the interview if you go back and look at the website and go directly to look at the websites and the books. So thanks again, Neil, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Okay, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Bye.